Hi, I'm Ed Nevard, and we're here today on Cybershow Reflections to discuss some great writings on the subjects of cybersecurity and computer science. The piece that Andy has chosen for us today is a landmark paper in computer science titled Reflections on Trusting Trust by Ken Thompson.
Hi there, Ed.
Hi, Andy. Perhaps you could begin by telling us who Ken Thompson is, and why an article written in 1984 with such a strangely recursive title is still so extraordinarily relevant today.
Okay, yeah, the title was a bit of a weird one, on trusting trust. So, yeah, it has this form that a lot of computer scientists express things this kind of weird way, in a sort of recursive way. You know, it's deliberate, and it's there to invoke the idea of an infinite regress. You know, it's turtles all the way down. Similar in philosophical shape to questions like who watches the watchers, or, you know, does God have a God, that kind of thing. And it posits the idea of trust as being something that's very, very slippery, that you can't really get a hold of, because trust in what, and therefore on what basis do you trust that previous thing, and then on what basis do you trust the thing that begets that, and it just escapes you constantly. Yeah, it's a very, very deep philosophical question, and it's highly relevant today in the era of so-called post-truth and disinformation, but it's also extremely relevant to computer security. And I think what's interesting about Thompson's paper is it also contains some, well, I won't call them mistakes, but they're cultural artifacts of the time, which are off target, and that makes it more interesting, and even it highlights an even more urgent problem, which I think is the impossibility of appeal to authority. We can unpack that later and maybe talk about why, you know, authority doesn't work in principle in the digital world. This is Reflections on Trusting Trust by Ken Thompson, written in 1984. I would like to present to you the cutest program I ever wrote. I will do this in three stages and try to bring it together at the end. Stage 1. In college, before video games, we would amuse ourselves by posing programming exercises. One of the favourites was to write the shortest self-reproducing program. Since this is an exercise divorced from reality, the usual vehicle was Fortran. Actually, Fortran was the language of choice for the same reason that three-legged races are popular. More precisely stated, the problem is to write a source program that, when compiled and executed, will produce as output an exact copy of its source code. If you have never done this, I urge you to try it on your own. The discovery of how to do it is a revelation that far surpasses any benefit obtained from being told how to do it. The part about shortest was just an incentive to demonstrate skill and determine a winner. Figure 1 shows a self-reproducing program in the C programming language. The purist will note that the program is not precisely a self-reproducing program, but it will produce a self-reproducing program. This entry is much too large to win a prize, but it demonstrates the technique and has two important properties that I need to complete my story. Firstly, this program can be easily written by another program. And secondly, this program may contain an entirely arbitrary amount of excess baggage that will be reproduced along with the main algorithm. In the example, even the comment is reproduced. As we see in the figure, the string is a representation of the body of this program, from 0 all the way to the end. Stage 2. The C compiler is written in C. What I am about to describe is one of the many chicken and egg problems that arise when compilers are written in their own language. In this case, I will use a specific example from the C compiler. C allows a string construct to specify an initialized character array. The individual characters in the string can be escaped to represent unprintable characters, For example, the string hello world /n has the /n character representing the new line character. Figure 2.1 is an idealization of the code in the C compiler that interprets the character escape sequence. This is an amazing piece of code. It, quote, knows in a completely portable way what character code is compiled for a new line in any character set. The act of knowing then allows it to recompile itself, thus perpetuating the knowledge. Suppose we wish to alter the C compiler to include a new escape sequence, /v, to represent the vertical tab character. The extension to figure 2.1 is obvious and is presented in figure 2.2. We then recompile the C compiler, but we get the diagnostic. Obviously, since the binary version of the compiler does not know about /v, the source is not legal C. We must, quote, train the compiler. After it, quote, knows what /v means, then our new change will become legal C code. We look up on an ASCII chart that the vertical tab is decimal 11. We alter our source to look like figure 2.3, and now the old compiler accepts the new source code. We install the resulting binary as the new official C compiler, and now we can write the portable version the way we had it in figure 2.2. This is quite a deep concept. It is as close to a learning program as I have ever seen. You simply tell it once, then you can use this self-referencing definition. Stage 3. Again, in the C compiler, in figure 3.1, it represents the high-level control of the C compiler, where the routine compile is called to compile the next line of source. Figure 3.2 shows a simple modification to the compiler that will deliberately miscompile source whenever a particular pattern is matched. If this were not deliberate, it would be called a compiler bug. Since it is deliberate, it should be called a Trojan horse. The actual bug I planted in the compiler would match the code in the Unix login command. The replacement code would miscompile the login command so that it would accept either the intended encrypted password or a particular known password. Thus, if this code were installed in binary and the binary were used to compile the login command, I could log into that system as any user. Such blatant code would not go undetected for long. Even the most casual perusal of the source of the C compiler would raise suspicions. The final step is represented in figure 3.3. This simply adds a second Trojan horse to the one that already exists. The second pattern is aimed at the C compiler. The replacement code is a stage 1 self-reproducing program that inserts both Trojan horses into the compiler. This requires a learning phase, as in the stage 2 example. First, we compile the modified source with the normal C compiler to produce a bugged binary. We install this binary as the official C compiler. We can now remove the bugs from the source of the compiler, and the new binary will reinsert the bugs whenever it is compiled. Of course, the login command will remain bugged with no trace in the source anywhere. What is the moral of this story? The moral is obvious. You cannot trust code that you did not totally create yourself. Especially, you cannot trust code from companies that employ people like me. No amount of source-level verification or scrutiny will protect you from using untrusted code. In demonstrating the possibility of this kind of attack, I picked on the C compiler. I could have picked on any program handling program, such as an assembler or a loader, or even hardware microcode. As the level of program gets lower, these bugs will be harder and harder to detect. A well-installed microcode bug will be almost impossible to detect. After trying to convince you that I cannot be trusted, I wish to moralize. I would like to criticise the press in its handling of the hackers, for example, the 414 gang, the Dalton gang, etc. The acts performed by these kids are vandalism at best, and probably trespass and theft at worst. It is only the inadequacy of the criminal code that saves the hackers from very serious prosecution. The companies that are vulnerable to this activity, and most large companies are vulnerable to this activity, are pressing hard to update the criminal code. Unauthorised access to computer systems is already a serious crime in a few states and is currently being addressed in many more state legislatures, as well as in Congress. There is an explosive situation brewing. On the one hand, the press, television and movies make heroes of vandals, calling them whiz kids. On the other hand, the acts performed by these kids will soon be punishable by years in prison. I have watched kids testifying before Congress. It's clear that they are completely unaware of the seriousness of their acts. There is obviously a cultural gap. The act of breaking into a computer system has to have the same social stigma as breaking into a neighbour's home. It should not matter that the neighbour's door is unlocked. The press must learn that misguided use of a computer is no more amazing than drunk driving of an automobile.
Join me as I speak to Andy on his reflections. So, Andy, who is Ken Thompson?
Ken Thompson's still around. He's in his 80s now. And I think we could describe him as a Jedi master of computer science. Certainly one of the top historically significant figures. He was very instrumental in laying the groundwork for regular expressions, which are used in searching. And he contributed a lot to the C programming language, if only through being basically writing the B programming language, which is a predecessor of C. And then later in his career, Go, which is a increasingly popular language. Go is used quite a bit. The backup plan for the post-apocalypse, Plan 9, of course, which is getting more and more attention these days. Yeah, he was also involved in virtualization, early ideas of virtual machines. So, you know, you could say that he was a big contributor to what we now call the cloud. And anyway, I mean, Ken Thompson won many, many prestigious awards, including being a Turing Award winner. So, it's a pretty impressive rap sheet, really, for Thompson.
Really is an impressive pedigree. Would you like to explain to our audience what makes this so fresh and relevant today?
I mean, it contains some extremely subtle and scary implications. Thompson wrote it in three stages. There are three parts to an argument, which is pitched really at technically literate people. It's pitched at computer scientists. I mean, obviously, it's written in the ACM, yeah? And so behind that, there's much that's hidden or assumed, if you like. So, you know, we are kind of in for a bit of a long segment on the show because I'd like to try and explain what those mean to a wider audience. So some of the concepts behind those three steps in the argument. The argument breaks down to these three steps, which are the idea of quines.
Could you just explain what a quine is? Isn't that like a computer virus?
The idea of self-replicating programs, named after the philosopher Villard Quine. He was a kind of logic guy, sort of positivist, naturalist, positivist guy. He didn't actually coin the phrase. I think Douglas Hofstadter did. He was talking about, and this clusters with a whole bunch of other things. So you can think of kind of Dawkins' idea of memes, pieces of code or information which are able to propagate themselves, right? So Thompson starts off with this idea, which is basically a computer virus, right? It's something which can at least just replicate itself when it runs. And then he, you know, naturally develops the idea of a malicious self-replicating code. But it's not the same as a virus, right? This is a really interesting angle, is that it's to do with the replicator rather than what is replicated. It's the thing which, the combinator which takes the bits of DNA, and whether or not that can be trusted to replicate the DNA, or whether, like a virus inserting its genetic code into another replicating organism, it can maliciously modify that and get it to carry its own information. There, so once we've developed this idea of deceptive malicious self-replicants, which I'll just call MSRs for now or something, what does that mean in terms of trust? What can we trust the tools that we use to build things? And since the entire edifice of computing is built on these steps where we're always building on previous architectures and building on libraries and APIs, how far do we need to dig down to find a potential malicious intervention in that? It could be something that was put there 20 years ago, yeah.
And didn't Thompson work with other giants like Ritchie, Pike and Kernighan?
He was at Bell Labs for a long time with figures like Dennis Ritchie, Brian Kernighan, Rob Pike, all those guys who were working on formative pieces of the Unix operating system and the C programming language.
You touched on the Unix operating system there. What makes it so important?
Well, the Unix operating system is the operating system, really. It's what we've kind of ended up with after years of evolution. I mean, obviously, there are other operating systems, embedded specialist things and, a few kind of marginal ones. But pretty much the world has converged on variations of the Unix operating system through, say, the Linux lineage. Now, there isn't a single, it's not a single operating system, right? There's has many, many faces, many variants. But yeah, it kind of started to appear in the late 70s and early 80s. And Ritchie, Thompson, Kernighan and Pike were big contributors to that at Bell Labs at the time. Unix isn't really a single operating system at all. In fact, that's the thing. It has so many faces. But they're all characterized by the same philosophy, which is you have a single kernel and a big user space, which is made of many smaller programs designed to interoperate and work together, each sort of performing a small, well-defined task. And it's that ecosystem together which produces all of the functionality that you want. It kind of goes slightly with philosophies of distribution and slightly against philosophies of centralization.
So obviously this work was done 40 or 50 years ago. Could you explain what makes this so relevant even now?
Yeah, it's a very, very deep philosophical question, and it's highly relevant today in the era of so-called post-truth and disinformation. But it's also extremely relevant to computer security. And I think what's interesting about Thompson's paper is it also contains some, well, I won't call them mistakes, but they're cultural artifacts of the time, which are off target. And that makes it more interesting and even it highlights an even more urgent problem, which I think is the impossibility of appeal to authority. We can unpack that later and maybe talk about why, you know, authority doesn't work in principle in the digital world.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems to me that the definition of a deceptive MSR Quine is exactly what ChatGPT-style large language models are in the process of becoming, no?
Yeah, I'm not even sure what it would mean to make the comparison between deceptive code hidden inside large language models and deceptive code hidden inside a compiler. We're seeing convergences of technologies where code is making code. The things we might worry about that are hidden inside large language models are essentially already hidden. I mean, they're not explicit because they are hidden within data sets. They're part of the annealing of what has been described as inscrutable matrices of floats. In other words, they're just a sea of data, which a human can't possibly interpret in any meaningful way. In fact, those training weights only make sense when combined with the code which is designed to decode it, to turn those weights into an output sequence. So I don't think you can make a like-for-like comparison of what Thompson's describing in the 1984 paper and what's going on with large language models. No, there's similar dangers there, but I don't think that they're congruent. So the problem really is not one of hidden data weights, but code that should be legible to us as humans, should be auditable, but isn't because of just excessive complexity.
Yeah, I mean, the ecosystems that we're in today, they're growing exponentially. We're adding millions of lines of code per day to these repositories, any of which may be fundamentally compromised, right?
Yeah, so that is kind of a really scary part. Enormous complexity of modern systems where you have 10 or 100 million lines of code in an automotive system, and people working on that system don't even know what large parts of it do. I mean, they won't touch it. They're too scared to touch it. It's just been there in the corpus of code for decades, and no one's really played with it because it was written by somebody in Fortran or some dialect of C, 20 years ago, and it just kind of exists as a blob. Well, I mean, this is an enormous subterranean, opaque underworld of code that nobody knows about. That kind of complexity of scale is also matched by a kind of layered complexity in that, things are built on top of things that are built on top of things that are built on top of things, in a way that we're sometimes not even sure about what some of the layers down below are. Well, if we take Thompson's warning there, that something which had trojaned that code long ago could still be self-replicating within that ecosystem. It could still be reinserting trojans into the login prompt, is his example, but it could kind of be anything like a network stack or whatever. We'd have absolutely no way of knowing about it, except by very careful observation of behaviours. And there might be behaviours which, even if you sat there on Wireshark for 10 years or something, you'd never catch, because it would only come up in a very precise and rare set of circumstances. So this is a kind of a real Achilles heel for the whole project of developing secure code, if you allow it to become as complex as we are allowing it to become.
So why is it, as you put it, an appeal to authority such an unsound security strategy?
Okay, well, appeal to authority, let's think of that in a sort of philosophical context. It's one of several arguments, if you like, or responses to a challenge. You can reason from first principles. You can have rationalism, so that's basically work it out for yourself. You can have empiricism, which is basically find out for yourself, go and observe something, do an experiment or whatever. And the third category is kind of phone a friend. Yeah, it's ask someone you trust, who is smarter than you, an expert or whatever, and then trust their response. And that's an appeal to authority. And an appealing to an authority, all of the philosophical methods of in epistemology have some kind of flaw, right? But the weakest of them all, in a way, is appeal to authority. And, it really becomes a problem, not when of your own volition you go to find something out and you realise that you can't work it out for yourself and you can't find it out for yourself. So you're forced to trust. You're forced to go to some authority. That's that's the weak version. The strong version of harm there is when you are forced to by an authority which tells you, you will trust us. You must trust us. We are the only agent that can provide you with any assurance or confidence, and therefore we're imposing this upon you. And this becomes really, really deeply problematic in what you might call a principal agent problem, where the person imposing the trust is not disinterested, right? They are wanting to manipulate, to extract data, to control, to do bad things to the person who's forced to be to entrust their security to them. And this comes down to this this definition of trust, which we need to talk about a little bit more.
Yeah, but nobody has time to read through millions of lines of other people's source code, right?
Yeah, exactly. They don't have time to read through a million lines of somebody else's source code. But also they might not have the capacity, right? They might not be smart enough to understand what that source code means.
So, Andy, what would you say trust means in the 21st century?
In the 21st century, I guess it means the same as it has always meant. I think trust is a fundamental human concept. And it's obviously modified by living in the digital age in many ways, but it's still the same thing. The definition of trust I like best, it allegedly attributed to national security agencies. So this is from some NSA document, which I saw referenced in Ross Anderson's security engineering textbook, and he has a chapter on trust with some great insights. But the NSA definition is something like, trust is the ability to do harm. In other words, when you trust in another entity, you grant them the ability to do harm to you. And that's a quite remarkable and compact definition of trust. And I don't think that that's the way that most people think about it, but they should, especially in computer security, when you're thinking about your phone or downloading an app or something to your phone. It's like you're literally granting the person who wrote that code the ability to harm you in some way tangibly, to steal from you, to waste your time, to take money from you, take your data, whatever.
Yeah, so what are some essential moral takeaways from Thompson's paper, and what lessons can be learnt from it?
Okay, well, I think there are two amazing takeaways from Thompson's paper. The first is obviously the main payload of what he was trying to communicate, this problem of complex chains of software, and that trust cannot be located very specifically, like in a few lines of source code or somewhere. It's a function of a much, much bigger ecosystem in which trust, and therefore the ability to do harm, is diffused in time and in space, in amongst a big complexity and collection of source code files, but also backwards in history. The second takeaway, I think, is even more significant, and it lies in that second part to the paper, which is not the technical payload, it's the social commentary, and Thompson's focus on what was the kind of issue du jour, which was like the way that the media had framed the threat, the cyber threat in the 1980s, and this is an absolutely colossal cultural artifact. It's something that we really need to pay attention to, that the focus was on a scapegoat, was the hacker culture, and they were kids. I think he says it about three times or four times. He paints this culture of irresponsible young crazy teenagers having fun, but this is all terribly serious and we need to change the law. This was emergent at that time, and I think it was a complete mistake. I think that what happened, the media, the mass media, the press, the way that it was framed in things like films like War Games, for example, and that kind of Hollywood hacker culture stuff, And to a certain extent still is today, with kind of things like Mr. Robot and things, is that it misdirects the attention onto the wrong perpetrators. You know, Thompson actually says it slightly earlier in the paper that the real source of this problem would come from inside a company. It's not the individual disgruntled hacktivist hacker who is the great threat. It's big tech, right? It's large companies which are highly profit motivated for extracting data, for, you know, in enmeshed in surveillance capitalism and this whole show of stuff. No, I mean, it's really big companies. It's the, you know, the data industrial complex putting malicious code in for Trojan horses, for untrustworthy and untrustable code. The main source of that and the market for it is not in these individual disgruntled hacktivist hackers that are sort of portrayed in the sort of Hollywood culture. And I think that we've kind of really missed something here in computer security, and it's only caught up with this very, very recently. We were always looking at the possibility that some rogue agent, some outsider, would insert some malicious code into a system, and not that the very DNA of the system might have from a very long time ago have been utterly compromised and continues to be compromised in a quite undetectable way.
So how can we go forward from this, and are there any countermeasures against these threats? Is it all doom and gloom?
Well, countering these threats is a very, very difficult task, and I think that's what Thompson's paper is all about. It's a bit of a scary paper because you suddenly see the futility of many supposed panaceas to computer security, one being, you know, source code review. So it may actually be important that we continue to revise code, that nothing gets ossified and kind of locked in place. That new code is good code, and also that simple code is always, always, always to be preferred to complex code. The principles of security by simplicity are just myriad and bountiful. There are so many ways in which, if you can reduce the attack surface, it can reduce the complexity, you can reduce the number of lines of code that need review, you just get gains all around. And interestingly, you know, this is where the Unix philosophy that I was talking about earlier actually really comes to fruition, is that when you have systems which are composed of many small things, each of which in themselves are relatively simple, but in concert provide complex behavior, you have a much better security footing because you can look at the in detail at those smaller components and weed out the ones that might be problematic. Another way forward is that we must not trust authority. We, as a technical community, as consumer community, as users of technology, absolutely you cannot trust something that somebody has told you should trust. To do so, when you have a choice not to, if you have any choice at all not to, then don't do it. Many of the ways that we obtain security are by the things that we do not do. Yeah? They are not doing more things and somehow those add up in a vector sum to making things more secure. That almost never happens. With every layer of solutionism that you add, with every new firewall, with every new intrusion detection system that you pile on top of the existing insecure stuff, you're adding more and more ways for that system to be insecure. Security is about rolling back complexity. It's about what you take out, a bit like kind of good music or good editing. When there's nothing left to take out, then it's probably as secure as it can be. And that philosophy needs reviving and championing in security engineering big time. We really need that back.
Such an incredible amount of depth packed into two sides of a piece of paper. Well, that just about wraps us up for this episode. Join Helen and I next time when we discuss the pros and cons of both open and closed source software from an all-important security perspective. Ed signing off for The Cyber Show. Thank you so much for joining, and we'll see you again soon.
The Cyber Show.